So I remember speaking to you last year during the same time when we did the when I first read about Jerry and Till 5, and that's when I reached out to you to cover a story on your amazing story.
I
So when you spoke,
remember.
spoke about people remotely connecting to the game board and playing games together, it was fun. It was fun, but I think that in the last 7 to 8 months, people have realized that this is something that people should definitely have, because now people are cut off. They are not able to travel. They are not able to meet their family, their friends. And if you have something like this, it's going to be really cool to keep connected and play together. And even if you're not playing, I would say that even if it's not playing, it's just a communication tool where you can
Yeah.
sit together, chat, and have fun. And in case you feel like playing, you open the board and start playing.
Exactly. You know, there's a lot of really fun things outside of pure gaming that you can do. So, you know, imagine grandma, grandpa connecting with the grandkids. You could open up a virtual sandbox where the grandkids are just pushing cubes and virtual sand and drawing. And grandma and grandpa could be drawing and like playing in the sandbox together. And it's not really a game, it's just a way to connect with your friends. And you know, I spend a lot of time watching industry trends and watching like reports. And you know, I would have never guessed, you know, a year ago when we did the Kickstarter campaign that the whole world would change so radically. But you know, it all indications is like everyone having to go through this trauma together has fundamentally changed the way families come together and play together, which is, we were already tapping into that. We believed that was a core part of how people wanted to play anyway, but now it's just been amplified. And that's not going to go away after COVID. It's like now part of society, like people just want to do this and they're going to continue to want to do it. And then people wanting to find ways to connect virtually. You know, we're frustrated, like we're using Zoom right now. It's just not good. It's not as good as if we could have some kind of 3D space. Like, I want to see you in 3D. I want to, you know, I'm describing these glasses, but I can't hand them to you. I want to be able to like digitize these glasses and hand them to you in the Tilt 5 3D space and just let you hold them and move them around and look at them and interrogate them. We could do that with our system. And it's just going to be this super powerful tool. You know, our main goal is to like solve one problem, and then we're gonna dice off another problem and another problem. And like there's so many directions we can go, but we're gonna nail this like kind of group gaming experience and then education and a bunch of other things from there.
It's
And then the glasses are gonna
it's
get smaller and lighter and more functional and
yes. So it's really I can relate to the way in which you spoke about the grandparents playing with their grandkids, because I have my daughter here and my parents are in India, so they keep connecting with them on a daily basis through a WhatsApp call or a Zoom call, and though they are connected, but there is the limited interaction that can happen through a voice call or a video call, which, as you said, if they are able to come together on a same platform like a Play-Doh making or a
yeah.
sandboard making, and then the interaction levels goes up, and then it becomes a great platform to be connected, and it's fun.
Yeah, and it's not the same as touching someone, but you know, if you can reach in and like push sand and you're touching the same sand, you just, I mean, I've experienced it 'cause I have the Tilt 5 system and we get to do these demos all the time, but you know, you feel connected to those people. Like
Definitely,
you just
definitely.
feel connected, and
Yes.
it's the next best thing to holding somebody's hand or touching somebody and having that intimate connection.
Yes, that's definitely going to be there. And for the hardcore gamers, they will definitely lap your product. And for them, this is going to be a awesome stuff to be. Because since you spoke about, I'll go back to your computers made easy. There was a phase in which you said that you had LAN connected games happening in one of your game shop or the shop which was converted into a gaming center. And I could see that. A lot of millennials Or rather, even people who used to play LAN games during those 90s, still continuing playing the latest generation LAN games and all, they will be more than happy to be experiment till 5, and because they know how it works, and they are just waiting for that next leap in that arena, and this is the perfect thing that can happen to them.
Yeah, you know, our current video gaming experience is fundamentally broken in a way. So in my living room, I like to play video games with other people. So I have 2 televisions, 2 Xboxes, 2 PlayStations. And that only lets me play video games with 2 people side by side. And that's a lot of work, a lot of money. I mean, I have a lot of money just to try to play games with my friends in the same room, because it's more fun when you play together. And, you know, it's okay playing over the internet. But with our system, it's so low cost. You know, it's, you know, $300, you get your headset, all your friends get a headset. Now it's seamless. You just flip open the game board. Now you have independent views into this game space, and you can play almost any game on it, right? So it can be as simple as checkers, or it could be as complicated as, you know, some kind of simulation action game, you know, pure video game. But it's, potentially, you can just share it like seamlessly without having to have like 2 monitors or 10 monitors, or like if you want 10 people, just have 10 friends come over with a headset.
Yes. So when I spoke to you last year and you explained about this whole gaming thing, and it can span out to any type of gaming industry, not just the whatever type of board game that is available in the market can be brought into Tilt 5. So that's why when I went out to the market searching for what are the levels and expertise that you would have worked in terms of putting it together, and I went and ended up going into a Warfare shop who they were making amazing stuffs, and I could see that people standing there painting the old broken castles and their the small toys and stuff like that. And then that's when I started realizing, when I started looking from the different angles and the top view and the side view, how difficult it would have been to put together this thing together. So how does this idea came together in terms of putting a board game into a holographic structure, and how challenging it was to actually bring it to life?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. So it kind of goes back to like, what can we do really well? What problem can we solve that has like a message that, you know, is very understandable? And when we settled on tabletop gaming, we started looking around like, how can we do that the quickest? And we're like, hey, there's companies out there that have full 3D board game systems that have thousands of games. So we reached out to some of those companies, and Tabletopia, for example, is a company that has over 1,000 games already. And we talked to them like, hey, you know, we can work with you. We can make this so it's holographic, and you've done 90% of the work. We'll help bring it to our system. And so by working with one partner, now we have 1,000 kind of traditional board games, everything from poker and checker and the classic games to, you know, they have digitized the European, German style, really complicated games right there. So that was pretty cool. And then you talked about going to like a wargaming, you know, center where you do these scenarios. They're really cool. I didn't know much about them either until I got kind of involved in this space. So it was kind of funny. I went to a wargaming conference. So at a hotel, like 1,000 or 2,000 people came together, and they were doing these war simulations and scenario kind of gameplay. And so I walk in the door and I start talking to these people. I'm like, hey, I'm building the system. It could like do all these amazing things. And this is a humbling moment. I kind of learned a valuable lesson. So I walk in, I said, like, you're painting all these little buildings and these little tanks and these little figures. And like, we could just do them all digitally, and you don't even need to do that anymore. I was so naive going in there. That's half the fun for them, you know? And they were like, oh, I'd never want to do that. Oh, it's terrible. Like, oh. And so I talked to them more and I started to get more understanding. And then there was another event. So I went back and I talked to them again. I'm like, so what if you could put your little figures and your buildings on top of our game board and I could help you put virtual fire onto it? Or there's a thing called hit radius, like when you roll the dice and it's whether your tank can shoot a missile or something far enough to hit the other person. What if we could help you kind of measure the distance, like do simple things like that? And they're like, oh, we would love that. Like, you know, adding smoke and fire to, you know, and ambience stuff. We want to keep our little figures because we paint those and we're so proud of them. And then I'm like, okay, what if we could digitize those? What if your friends can't come over and play? What if we could just digitize the one you painted? And then for your friends that can't show up, they can see everything digitally, remotely. And they're like, oh yeah, we would do that. So, you know, humbling moment. I had to learn about the market more. And then, so we went out and we found some partners that have, turns out there's companies that make for LCD screens. People lay big television screens on their table and they play wargaming type games on LCD screens. And there's companies that do this. So, you know, we reached out to them like, hey, can we help you bring that to our system? They're already making all the little models and things in 3D. Now they just automatically like pop up out of the table and work seamlessly for those folks. And so those are some of the things that we did to try to stay focused and like provide a lot of experiences for the people that get Tilt 5. And then we're also working to get like a lot of pure video games too. Good. So
yes, this is amazing. Before I touch upon little areas of the tie-up that you have done in terms of the gaming, before that, I wanted to talk about keeping your platform open for the developers to tweak and do their own stuff. So you say that I think that the SDKs are open, openly available, and people can, the gamers or the developers can tweak around and play around with that. So why did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, part of it's a business strategy. Like, we want as many people developing for our system as possible. So we've made every single pair of glasses capable of being a developer kit. And we've made that completely free. You can go to GitHub and you can download the tools and you can work with it. And we even made an emulation. So like, even if you don't have the hardware yet, you can take our SDK and it has a bunch of little features where you can visualize what it's going to look like before you even use the glasses, which is really handy. And that's all free and available. We don't charge a game developer any money. We felt that was important. You know, we want the platform to be as open as possible. And there's like these unsettling trends right now in the market that I really rally against. You know, and in particular, like Facebook is the company that I worry about the most in this space. Facebook is trying through their pure like monopoly power to like own kind of the XR space. And their motivations are going back to reading people's minds and being able to manipulate people. Their business is getting you hooked on Facebook and constantly engaging, constantly clicking like, and constantly feeding you advertisements to manipulate you into doing things or buying things. That's how they make their money. And so a nightmare scenario for me is that Facebook wins and they become the AR company of the future. And we're wearing our glasses in 15 years where we're walking down the street. It's reading my mind. It knows everything I like. It knows everything I look at. It knows everyone I'm talking to. It knows my most vulnerable moment to pop an ad up, to manipulate me, to do something. I mean, so much bad could happen from this. And so our core philosophy, we want to go completely opposite of that, like privacy. We don't want to manipulate people. We can make money by being the good company that's not doing those sketchy things. And I think there's more awareness of what's going on and these business models like the Facebook business model. And hopefully there's going to be some laws passed eventually that protect people's privacy and how they can be manipulated. And it's going to force all the companies to be good, right?
Yes.
Make money in more ethical ways.
Yes. So when you spoke about the stint that you had in Valve, wherein you were putting those stuffs on your head, mm-hmm. and trying to capture the emotional moments, and then you said that it can be ethical as well as unethical in terms of capturing the people's mind and pushing the emotional content to them. So when you look back, and now you look at the way in which technology companies who want to push advertisements and other related content to you, just by looking at the emotional quotients, or rather the way in which you browse through the internet, it is definitely, yes, definitely scary. And you would want companies to be open, and as you said, you need good companies to be there and make sure that people's privacy are kept at bay, and they enjoy doing what they want to do without compromising on the privacy part.
Yeah, you know, it is scary, because, and I even, not too many years ago, felt this way, until I learned more, and thanks working at Valve and like being involved with this industry, I've learned a lot. And, you know, we don't stand a chance against, you know, a Facebook and their supercomputers that understand us emotionally better than we do. Even though we think that we're in control, we are primitive brain, you know, animals that can be manipulated. And there's more and more studies that show, like, you only have to show a person a falsehood not very many times, and it starts to become reality to them. And so, you know, if we have glasses that are very immersive and very linked to us at a very visceral, primal level, that's just an even better tool to subtly manipulate us and present us with small falsehoods, or to understand our weakest moment, to just go in and like manipulate us right at that moment. Not good. But I think, you know, when I reflect back, you know, how could engineers in these big companies be working on things that seem so bad, right? I think about that a lot. And then I think back to my days working at Valve Software, you know, doing these first experiments with reading people's emotions and feeding those back into the games. And I was excited about that. And it was so fascinating. It's like, we can make games more fun by feeding the emotions back into the director of the game. And I was just thinking about it as like, this is a big technical challenge. And being an engineer, it's like, ethics, like someone else in the company will think about ethics. Like, I'm just doing what I'm told to make games more fun. But, you know, over the years, I started thinking about, and I actually, you know, ran into some folks that work in like casino gambling companies. And they told me about like the manipulation that's even in those machines. And it's just like, I started to get this kind of ethical worldview. Again, like I said, like sometimes you think you have arrived and you're there and there's like, you know it all. And then like a few years go by, like 4 or 5 years go by, and now this whole like ethics of like AI and, you know, manipulating people, I hadn't even thought about it. But it was there the entire time. Like the casino people, the big innovation they made in the 90s is these casino machines, they make a sound when you win, right? Yeah. And that goes right to your brainstem. And when you win, you get this association. It's like, oh, it feels really good. And it doesn't, you only, just like being told a falsehood just a few times, you only have to hear that sound and win a few times, and then it gets locked into your brain and you get manipulated.
Then you keep trying to get that kick again.
Yeah. And so they teach you what that win sound is, and it's almost universal across all of these machines. It's kind of the sound of coins dropping and bells and stuff like that. But they're big innovation. And this is like, is this ethical or not? We should think about this, right? It's like they changed playing the game for like, you put one coin in, pull the handle, and you might win or you might lose. they made it so you could put like 4 or 5 coins in at a time and you pull. And if you put 5 coins in and you only end up winning 1 coin back, they give you the win sound, even though you've lost, you know, 4 of your coins, but you still get the emotion of winning. So you're sitting there losing money like crazy and you just feel like you're winning. And they figured that out in the 90s. You know, apply that to our technology today, like how advanced it's getting. It's just like, it could be so subtle. Like you would never know. They could just be steering an entire nation, you know, and we would never know, right?
Yes. I will stay away from the November 3rd thing that's going to happen. coming back to the fun and happy moments of gaming, and I could I could see a Monopoly and a Star Wars behind you when you spoke about Monopoly on the other side. You have tied up with very, very interesting board game developers. Can you speak about one or two of the interesting game developers that you have tied up with in terms of the board games?
Yeah, on the board game side, I think I mentioned it earlier, Tabletopia, I'm pretty darn excited about those folks. We have some other things in the works that we're kind of keeping like pulled back a little bit so we can have some exciting news. But Tabletopia is super exciting because they have such a huge catalog of content that's going to be available on the system. So pretty much anything you want to play, you know, a style game is going to be there. So it can be like, you know, as simple as a checkers kind of game and your classics. And these are all licensed, right? They went out and got the license for them. So they're legitimate versions of the games. To the Gloomhaven games, which is like a super popular game right now. That's got, I don't know how many. I have the box over here. I just received it. It's a box this big. It weighs like, it just weighs so much. It's got hundreds of pieces. Anyway, that they have games like that in there. Then we have a partnership with Fantasy Grounds. If you're into Dungeons and Dragons, so more like fantasy role-playing. And so they have hundreds and hundreds of D&D campaigns. And so basically the way their system works is you get to see your D&D map laid out in front of you. It's not super 3D, but it's like giant because it's there on the table. And then they have all these story elements that you can like tie in, and it's a great storytelling tool. I'm working with a company called Battle Map Studio. So for that kind of wargaming style where you use figures and stuff, Battle Map Studio is a tool where you can create these terrains with all kinds of like trees and hills and valleys and stuff. And so you can build out your entire like, you know, place where you're going to have this mock battle ahead of time and just make it completely customizable, and all your friends can now play on your map that you've created. So we're chasing down tons and tons of content like that. And so our next phase in the company, so we raised the $7.5 million, and we talking about composition of investors and like who you brought on. It's like, I learned some lessons, right? It's very clear with the investors. Here's our plans. Like this next step is we're getting content. We're expanding the team and content. That's what we're going to do. And all our objectives for this next round of money is to make sure that we have like this content pipeline of like lots and lots of things in the next 12 to 14 months for people that buy the system to play. Great. And from that, that'll be super important. Like if we can do that and be successful, then we have a viable business and we, you know, can sell more units and we can be the good people.
Yes. So before we talk about the return on investment for the investors and the money that you have raised from the Kickstarter, if I understand correctly, when you are in Tilt 5 and you're playing the game, one of the challenges when you, which I have faced because I've used a couple of VR headgears to come out with some activities for marketing and stuff like that, you get completely cut off from the original reality that's happening around you. And you're completely cut off. And when I read about Tilt 5, one of the features that I liked about Tilt 5 is that you are still part of your surroundings, and you can still order your pizza and your chips, and then you can still see that and do that. So how do you do that?
So, you know, a virtual reality system is, you know, it's fun to play VR. It's a solo kind of experience because you get blocked off. It's, you put these giant ski goggles on and you can walk around your living room into this completely synthetic world, which is neat. But, you know, it's kind of a novelty. You know, you don't really, most people don't play games that way. And so it wasn't really exciting for me to build a product around that because I don't want to build a novelty. I want to build something that someone will actually use for extended periods of time and be able to like have their friends around and participate. So it was essential that our glasses have lenses that you can see right through. So I can see my hands, I can see my pizza, I can see my friends. Like when I win, I can be like, they can see it in my eyes. So that was a design requirement. And so it was super important. And the lenses had to be tinted so you could actually see your friend's eyes. And that was another requirement. So we did a lot of work. Like one of our patents is around, you know, these lenses that are in here, just the way we build them so that they reflect light efficiently, yet you can still see your eyes. I mean, lots of work went into just making this thing that looks so simple on the system. But it was a user experience.
Yes, because for someone who has used a augmented reality tool or a VR gear, I have never experienced which is stuffs which are not making your head heavy. Because whatever you used to, at some point in time, maybe in the initial feel of using it doesn't make you think about the weight, but after you use it for continuously for 3 to 4 minutes, your head becomes heavy and you cannot continue more than 10-15 minutes, though you may push yourself because of the experience. But it's cool to see that you have come out with something which is as light as a normal spectacles that a person wears and moves around. So that's very interesting.
Something really subtle about our system that, you know, it may be a little technical, but it's really special about our system too, and this was a design requirement as well, is in a virtual reality system, you have a set of plastic lenses in front of your eyes. And, you know, anyone that's worked with a camera before, you know, knows if you have like a camera with, you know, the lens opened up really big, you have a very shallow depth of field, so where it focuses at. And so in a VR headset, they have very big lenses with a big aperture, which means they have one focal sweet spot, which is really far away from the user. And so there's this conflict. When the virtual objects get close to you, you have to trick your brain into focusing at a different depth than where the object is. And so that's subtly strainful on your experience. So after 10 minutes, you start to feel eye strain because you're having to force yourself to focus like way out in the distance because of these big, big aperture lenses. Our system, actually, the way we designed it, has extremely small aperture. It has a pinpoint aperture, which means we create a light field which is accurate, you know, between the tip of the user's nose all the way to the table and back again. So you can, if you have a virtual object that's kind of floating, you know, right in front of you, you can focus on it, and then everything, all the other virtual objects behind you, go out of focus correctly. Or if you focus down at the virtual objects that are down on the table, they go into focus and the thing that's up close to you goes out of focus, just like in the real world. And so it's super comfortable. And that's when people try our system, they can't put their finger on why it feels better than VR. They're always saying it's because it's lighter, it's more vivid. What is it? And it's because we generate a pinhole, you know, depth of field, which is accurate to the real world. And so it's just one of my nerdy things. It was one of my innovations in the system. Wow. And I'm proud of it.
It's amazing. It's like you put it across very in a very simple, effective manner in terms of what's the difference is. But when actually it comes into effect, it makes changes the complete scenarios. Definitely for a gamer, because when you're talking about board games or any strategy games which goes on for hours, you need people to be stress free and focus on the game and enjoy the game rather than struggling to focus and changing their focal points and stuff like that. So this is a very subtle way in which you have solved a great problem, because I would not say it's a great problem. I would say that since you have a background of gaming yourself, you are a gamer, so you know the challenges or the which can happen when you are playing for a longer duration. And
I think my design thought process, and well, our whole team, I look for people that have a very similar kind of design sense, and I pick this up. So I think I've had a lot of great mentors along the way that taught me how to think about the trade-offs you make in a consumer product. One of my mentors told me, he's like, if you make a great product, there's going to be features in it that you're super proud of. But if you've done your job, it fades into the background and they don't even realize why it's happening. So I'm always looking for those things, like the depth of field thing, having a small pinpoint aperture. It's like one of those things when I discovered it, I'm like, oh, this is amazing. But it's not like one of those things we can put on the outside of a box and any customer's ever going to get excited about. They're just going to try the product and they'll be like, it just feels better than the other guys. The wand, like I tell you about like the shape of the wand and people make fun of it. Like our customers are going to make fun of it all the time, which is fine. They can make fun of it. It looks silly, but it's one of those subtle design features that we tested, you know, 100 different things. We know it's perfect. Like it's the way people should interact.
And does that develop as a Star Wars light?
Yeah, well, of course. That was one of the first demos we had to do. It's like make a lightsaber come out of, I can't say that. See, copyright, a light sword. another thing, well, people made fun of it looking like a barbecue lighter. So of course we had to make a demo where you pull the trigger and at the end it starts a little fire, virtual fire, of course.
Yeah,
great. For fun.